The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
Good morning and welcome to Squawk Box. We are live in Rotterdam and London today. Here are your headlines. The S&P 500 snaps a six-day losing streak and Nvidia sees its best trading day in over a month as Magnificent Seven earnings take focus. Tesla tumbles another 3% for its seventh straight loss as investors brace for what could be the EV maker's worst earnings in 7 years.
German software giant SAP sees a 24% surge in quarterly cloud revenue that eyes greater growth from AI services. We'll talk through the numbers then. The CEO, Christian Klein, that's at 7:30 CET.
The Dutch Deputy Prime Minister Rob Jetten criticizes the European Commission, telling CNBC here at the World Energy Congress, Brussels can do way more to speed up the energy transition.
Paperwork isn't going to solve this crisis, and what we need to do now is really build out our infrastructure on a much faster pace than we've done before.
Good morning, everyone. Busy old day on the earnings front, and we've got numbers already rolling across the tape from Novartis, a company that's had a somewhat soggy performance year to date and also the course of last year. The company saying its first quarter core EPS has crossed at $1.8. The estimates was for a number slightly lower than that. So it is a beat on the EPS line, 1.8, the number there. Now, it's delivered double-digit sales growth and core margin expansion in the first quarter, also going on to raise its guidance for the year. So positive signals coming out of this first 3 months of the year. Net income in Q1, that's crossed at almost $2.7 billion. The net income line, $3.68 billion. In terms of the sales print, $11.8 billion versus estimates for $11.4 billion. So again, beating on that number. When it comes to the operating income line, $4.5 billion. Also topping out, so higher than expected on a number of these different metrics. But I think the fact that we've seen guidance already raised at this early stage in the year, that is positive. That first quarter net sales line up 11% and the core operating income up 22%. Certainly a positive signal for the company at this stage as we get the numbers today. Just digging into the press release and it's saying the key drivers continue to be strong sales momentum. Entresto, this is one of the drugs we've spoken about for a long time. Cosentyx as well, a number of the key blockbuster drugs seeing decent numbers. Kesimpta also up 66%, heavy lifting from that particular drug. And Kisqali, that is up 54%. So fairly strong numbers as we talk about drivers here on some of those key blockbuster drugs. We will be speaking across the course of the day. Our colleagues have an interview with the Novartis CEO, Vas Narasimhan. That is at 1700 CET.
Let's head on over to the auto sector then as well. We're getting some earnings news then out of Renault then early this morning, an early beat on these numbers. And really, investors had been really pleased with this company ever since, if you want to take a look at the year-to-date one as well, just up around 28% year-to-date. Ever since then, deciding not to list their IPO in Ampere, seemingly that stock has gone back up then to recent highs. Just a quick look at the numbers then. Revenue coming in at 11.71 billion euros. That's a 5.9% uptick then in constant exchange rate terms for the company. Also doing well when it comes to sales then for the first quarter, the first 3 months of the year, up 2.6%. versus the first quarter of 2023, recording 549,000 sales then in the month. A strong order book as well, two and a half months of forward sales, should I say as well, reflecting a good start to that financial year. And also confirming then their financial outlook for 2024, as I said, 11.7 billion in terms of group revenue then for the first 3 months of the year. Q1 sales rising, as we said, 1.8% or so as well in this time period. So a good set of earnings overall for the company.
So from pharma to autos, let's take a look at chemicals this morning. Akzo Nobel out with numbers today. The company's performance, a little bit soggy as well. We've seen some weakness in this company over the course of this year and last year. Q1 EBIT, €261 million. This is above estimates, 251, the number that the market was looking at. In terms of adjusted EBITDA, that is at €363 million. Also topping estimates that were slightly shy from that number at $348 million. So a strong hand today. The company backing its 2024 view. What we're seeing from that cash from operating activities, that is negative $170 million. The company also is looking to deleverage to an extent, aiming to lower its leverage to around 2.3 times net debt EBITDA by the end of 2024. I think that's an interesting line as we talk about higher credit costs at the moment. For the midterm, Akzo Nobel aims to expand profitability to deliver an adjusted EBITDA margin of above 16%. Don't forget, this is a company that was seeing a stabilization in volumes last year, was talking about outperforming its market. So now, as we look at this volume story, organic sales up 2%. Seems slim, doesn't it? Driven by higher volumes, though, in both paints and coatings. Revenue down 1%. So we're going to talk more about the volumes coming through the business and also on pricing stability with the company's CEO. Greg Pre-Guillaume will be joining us at 8:10 CET. That's a first on CNBC. Oil is stabilizing as investors continue to assess the latest risks out of the Middle East, including new sanctions on Iran. That says ministers and executives gather in Rotterdam for the World Energy Congress. Steve caught up with the Dutch Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Climate and Energy, Rob Jetten. He asked if Brussels is doing enough to help member states move towards renewables.
I'm also quite critical on the European Commission because we've had an enormous energy package, part of the Green Deal, but paperwork isn't going to solve this crisis. And what we need to do now is really build out our infrastructure on a much faster pace than we've done before. I'm very proud that the Netherlands is the first country to deliver on a hydrogen backbone throughout the country. But if you take a look at our electricity grid, we need to double it in a few years' time. Same goes for a lot of other EU member states. But it's taking us 8 years to get all the permits in place. So we do need some breakthrough decision-making in Brussels to really speed up the process of building out our infrastructure and making sure that we both put public and private money in the right place.
But given what you just said about the drift to the right and their lack of commitments to renewables compared with the centre, that doesn't sound like a commission post-June parliamentary elections that's going to deliver.
Well, I think me, myself, and a lot of others are pushing the commission to put the energy transition on the top of the agenda of the next commission. Also, energy independency. So how can we make sure that wind from the North Sea, sun from the south, hydropower from the north of Europe can be interconnected and that we really scale up the green hydrogen production on our continent. I think this is also the way forward on a national level. Here in the Netherlands, we've been able to really come to a better debate on our energy mix because it was all had to be renewables or all had to be nuclear. No, we are now doing both, and that is actually helpful in making sure that everyone gets along.
Steve also spoke to Lebanon's energy minister, who said the latest conflict in the Middle East is undermining energy stability.
Lebanon is playing his part in the energy transition, in the move towards a better future for the people, for its people, but also for the planet. At the same time, there is an overarching message that I think any one of us, especially in our part of the world, has to bring forward, which is to call for an immediate return to peace and an immediate stopping of the hostilities and the honoring of international resolutions, such as the UN resolution for Israel to honor a ceasefire and stop the unnecessary killings of the thousands of people that we are seeing today. So that is always a message that I'd like to bring. At the same time, this is about energy. Yeah. Energy is also a clearly dependent on geopolitical stability. Without stability, a lot of our effort are undermined.
Let's get out to Steve. He joins us from the World Energy Congress in Rotterdam. Steve, I haven't spoken to you in over a week, so nice to see you. Let me ask you about what you're learning around the energy market, because the letter report the other week on the single market was calling out energy and that they wanted to see some use to leverage the single market to ensure that there's more competitiveness.
Yeah, or at least some competitiveness would be nice, because as Fatih Birol pointed out, Karen, quite recently, Europe has made some historic mistakes in its energy policy, first relying way too much on Russia, which, again, something, dare I say it, some of us criticised for a very long time, the Merkel approach, so to speak, and then giving up on nuclear, which many people see as an absolutely pivotal baseload of power which you can use amidst the transition for more variable energy sources such as solar and wind as well. But let me move the conversation on, because I'm delighted to say the CEO and Secretary General of the World Energy Council, Angela Wilkinson, has joined us. And it's really lovely to see you again, because last time we were chatting, we were in Dubai, of course, for the COP28. Karen made a very good point about the need for Europe to be competitive amidst this transition, the need for better regulation, the need for a better transition, or perhaps a more coherent transition as well. Europe isn't the only part of the world that's struggling with this whole concept, is it?
Morning, Steve. No, of course not. I mean, it's a global energy transition, or we would say transitions. There's no one single transition. Yeah. Regions have different starting points, they have different needs and interests, and so there's no single pathway, and everybody's struggling. Yes, it's not a simple challenge of just swapping out one tech and putting in a new one. It's a big change.
And you made a very interesting point, I think it was last night you were speaking, but it was picked up in a piece I was looking at, that actually you need to redefine and reclaim this transition stroke transitions as well, because it is polarizing, it is loaded, it is a source of confusion and misunderstanding. I think that's the understatement of the year almost. It is absolutely loaded and confusing, isn't it?
It's mind-boggling. There's so many different pieces of this puzzle that have to be managed at the same time. And that's a challenge for everybody. Businesses can't do this on their own. Governments can't do them on their own. Mayors can't do it on their own. So we're bringing them all together here in Rotterdam. Mm. And we're saying, what is the new energy ecosystem, the new change maker system that really needs to be put in place? Because we can't have businesses saying, governments, you need to regulate better. Regulators saying to businesses, you need to step up. We're just going around pillar to post all the time. We've got to accelerate that change-making process.
But I think something that I hear time and time again from energy executives, dare I say, historically oil and gas executives, is the need to solve the trilemma, not just the transition. And I wonder, and I've thought a lot about this, these two different concepts. The trilemma being, it needs to be equitable, just, it needs to be secure, and it needs to be affordable as well. Is the trilemma, and the first time I've ever asked this, so you shoot me down. Is the trilemma a way of diluting, actually, the energy transition for these companies?
Absolutely not. We put the trilemma together. The World Energy Council actually provides the World Energy Trilemma framework. We put it together in the 1980s to connect the dots between energy and sustainable development. Mm. The energy transition from what to what? We're transitioning, some parts of the world are transitioning to clean, affordable, reliable modern energy supplies. Some parts of the world are transitioning away from unabated fossil fuels, right? So transitions are different. But the trilemma is the most powerful framework we have for measuring performance. Yeah. How do you know if you're managing your energy transition? So it's the way of measuring the performance of energy transition, and you can't reduce it to a single dimension.
No, and I'm glad you such a spirited reaction to my question, which means I'm hitting the right nerve. But I can't help thinking that there are energy executives who look at their trilemma and think, well, great, if we say we've got to provide secure energy and we've got to provide affordable, then that can actually dilute the sustainable angle. It means we can carry on longer saying, well, we've got communities that need affordable energy. They need to be able to industrialise. Hence, we can carry on producing oil and gas. And obviously, we need secure because the wind doesn't blow all the time and the sun doesn't shine as well. So if we carry on with oil and gas, or specifically gas in this case, we can kind of get a pass on going full tilt on transition or transitions.
It's not a dichotomy. It's a trilemma. If you fail to manage all three parts, you've got one leg missing from your stool. You're going to fall over. Yeah. You're heading for crisis. Yeah. No, you can't do it. You can't use. The whole point is you can't use trilemma as an excuse for ignoring one of the pillars.
Yeah. JP Morgan's Christian Marlec, he's not over here, I checked, because I'm quite happy to speak to him about it. He's put out a piece to JP Morgan clients in the last week or so, talking about a reality check being needed, actually, as well, that high inflation, high cost of money, and two devastating wars, specifically, I guess, what's going on with Ukraine, he's talking about, because we haven't actually seen output declines in the Middle East as well. This is creating a new reality on the ability to transition, and actually we need to speak in decades rather than years. How do you feel about that?
I think there's a new reality for everything we're doing, geopolitically, environmentally, and socially. You know, we're living in a world where, if you look at the World Energy Issues Monitor that came out this year, commodity prices and geopolitics are the biggest uncertainties. The biggest action priority is how do we get investment in transmission? That's not happening. We've got a lot of investment going into renewables in parts of the world that really are rich in energy resources, very little investment in renewables going into making a difference of billions of better lives for people that really need energy. I'm glad to say, JP Morgan, you're catching up. If you'd read the World Energy Issues Monitor this year, you'd have seen that we have been saying for at least 4 years, there's no such thing as a quick, easy, straightforward energy transition. And we can't rely on the markets, we can't rely on regulation alone to do it. We've got to have the pull of social transformation involved.
You mentioned social, and you've just taken me back nearly 9 years to November, December 2015, which was the pivotal Paris Agreement in Paris, where I was there, and Cristiana Figueres was running around herding cats, as she called it, to me and others as well. But the fact of the matter is, then India and the developing nations said this isn't equitable, it's not social. But you've just said to me, pretty much, that's what's happening, i.e. most of the money being spent is still by OECD nations, by rich nations. It is not filtering through to those emerging developing nations that need it as well. That says to me, that's quite damning. That says nothing's really changed in the attitude on a global basis.
Well, I think when we put, there's nothing wrong with the climate change frameworks, but I think, first of all, I think we energy leaders have done a rubbish job in energy literacy. And actually, most of the conversation has been about substituting supply without transforming demand. Yeah. And you can't transform demand when you haven't got any energy that you're using. So for a large part of the world, you know, if we're really serious about just, orderly, equitable and inclusive transitions, then we've got to ask, where's demand coming from? And demand is going to rise from many emerging and developing economies to come. And if, you know, a lot of people are talking about this transition from a place of comfort and convenience.
Yeah.
Is that really what energy transition's about? If energy transition is really about how do we have more energy for people and planet, that's why we're here. Redesigning energy for people and planet, using the trilemma, Steve.
Using the trilemma. Well, I'll carry on with that line of question because I think it will pique some interest from the energy executives as well. Thank you so much. Really nice to see you. We have to leave it there, but I'm looking forward to all the interviews and panels over the next couple of days as well. That's Angela Wilkinson, of course, in fine form despite this early hour and having to work late into the night as well, CEO and Secretary General of the World Energy Council. Let me hand it back to you guys in the studio.
Steve, thank you so much for that. Then, of course, we'll continue the conversations at the World Energy Congress then across the day as well. Now, coming up on the show, Tesla shareholders are bracing themselves for what could be the firm's worst set of earnings in 7 years. We'll find out why, and we'll do that next. Plus, cloud revenues at German software maker SAP jumping 24% in the first quarter as AI boosts demand. We'll speak to the CEO, Christian Klein. That's happening later this hour. Plus, more earnings on deck, of course. Later on in the show, we'll be speaking to the CEO of AkzoNobel. Don't miss that interview. It's at 8:10 CET.
Listen to CNBC's Beyond the Valley, the podcast that explores the biggest tech news from across the globe. Join me, Arjun Karpal.
And me, Tom Chitty, every week as we bring you insights into the top stories, unpack the latest trends, and find out where the industry is headed.
Now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
Welcome back. Well, we've broken the cold weather, haven't we? Not necessarily in terms of weather, in terms of here in the UK, but certainly in terms of the market. We had been seeing a bit of a downturn then across the trading days. Then 6 days of declines, pretty much what you saw out of the United States. That's been broken somewhat with a gain then across the board, especially for the tech-heavy NASDAQ, more than 1% higher. In fact, then yesterday, a good start to the week then, having seen Wall Street record what was its longest losing streak then since October 2022. So significant uptick here in this market. Does this mean that the bull market is back on? Does this mean that that was just that short-term uptick then for the market? We'll certainly see how things fare. Now, let's head on over to tech. And as one of our earnings editors stateside, Robert Hamill, has said, well, here come the heavyweights, right? It is that tech earnings week for this week, next week, and of course, we're anticipating NVIDIA a little bit later on. Big tech shares outperforming yesterday outside of Tesla. Of course, they have also dropped prices in their key markets then on the back of difficulty in that EV space as well, trying to gain up a few margins. Of course, we are expecting earnings out of that company as well a little bit later on, but earnings on the front here being very significant. NVIDIA trying to claw back some of the losses recently. It's been down around 14%. Over the last month or so. Now, dollar crosses very quickly then. Strong dollar continuing to pressure, particularly the Japanese yen of late, easing up somewhat today, but still 154.76. We're heading off to the Bank of Japan's interest rate decision then on Friday. Of course, speculation still rife that now 155 could certainly be the mark for intervention. Of course, we did hear as well, even just around a day or so ago, that the Bank of Japan will be cutting back then its purchases of Japanese bonds. So we'll take a quick look at the bond yields as well out of Japan a little bit later on. Some weakness then still for sterling and euro, but it is just marginal. On to the commodities very quickly then. Well, oil prices edging higher then today, as you can tell, on 0.2% to the good then for WTI, 0.5% higher than for Brent crude oil. Having sat at 90, we are down to $87.50. We did see that run up then just yesterday. Of course, Middle Eastern tensions somewhat easing as well in this market. Spot gold then dipping off from its recent highs, but still sitting in lofty territory right now, right? 0.2% down though in this early morning trade. Asian markets then, where we are across the board then, extending gains as tech shares rebounded out of Wall Street. So you're seeing that rebound come through as well in the Asian market. The likes of TSMC have moved up more than 1% as well in today's trading. So again, following through with that tech shift that we're seeing across the board. The chip sector has actually lost quite a bit then. Focus shifting, of course, to earnings results then from the data that we have seen. But there is still more data in this market. The Shanghai Composite following through from what it saw yesterday, 0.5% down. European market closed well. We saw the FTSE 100 actually hit a record closing high then, above 8,000 points, 1.2% to the good then for the FTSE 100. Again, some of the basic resources, oil and gas stocks, those were the ones really pushing the FTSE 100 of late then. And so too was pretty much the case then yesterday, clocking its fourth daily gain yesterday and ending that session above 8,000 points is pretty much what we saw for the FTSE 100. Only the FTSE MIB going in the opposite direction, Karen.
Arabile, let's take a look at earnings again as Renault has reported first quarter revenue of 11.7 billion euros on the back of a strong order book in Europe. The French carmaker also confirmed its full-year outlook. Charlotte joining us with more. Charlotte, the CFO stating the obvious about the EV market at the moment, almost a bit Homer Simpson-esque. We've got the EV market is a bit slower than we expected a few years ago. I mean, the writing's been on the wall now for a lot of automakers.
And yet for Renault, they've been on that strategy for a little while. As you were saying, the numbers just in line with expectations. They had announced in their targets for 24 lower margins because they know there's a slower demand and a lot of investment for that shift to EV. So they have reconfirmed these targets of margin of 7.5% at least. Remember, there was 7.9 last year. So lower margins as they are under pressure here again. But as you were saying, those revenues have up 5.9%, excuse me, at constant exchange rate. They have strong order book in Europe at 2.5 months of forward sales. And again, Renault had been working on that, changing their strategy. You remember they carved out their EV unit Ampere. They decided to not go ahead with an IPO at the end of last year. They had enough money, they said, to invest in the business without having to go to the market. In terms of their ICE unit, they call Horse. They said they're still in talks with Geely and Aramco on an ICE powertrain GV, and that they are at an advanced stage on those talks, according to the CFO this morning. Again, they had announced some previous targets last year to lower EV costs by 40% by 2027 and the hybrid cost by 30% by the same date. And they try to make EVs more affordable to try to get that demand back on board. They've launched that iconic Renault 5 R5 R5 that they will sell for under €25,000, and that's where they're really trying to push a strategy, make those EVs a bit cheaper, a bit more affordable, to try to reboost that demand at the moment. But they know that 23 is a bit of a tough year, a bit of a turnaround year, but at the moment those numbers there for Q1 are in line with expectations.
We know why it's called horse. Is that around horsepower? That's the reason
so.
Why. Yeah, it's an unusual name, isn't it? Speaking of which, let's take a look elsewhere too at EVs. Charlotte, thank you very much for that. Tesla shares extended declines after the bell after notching their seventh straight day of losses during the session, hitting their lowest level since January last year. The stock is down more than 40% for the year, losing at Tesla more than $300 billion in market cap since the end of 2023. Arabelle.
Yeah, Karen. So all of this, of course, comes ahead of what Wall Street expects will be a dismal set of first quarter earnings release from the automaker. Then not only is net income seen down on the year, it's expected to sink then almost 40%. In fact, then $1.81 billion on that mark. That on the back of what LSEG estimates will be the firm's first revenue decline since the onset of the pandemic. Now, it has also had a bad week. It's been a tumultuous time then for Tesla, of course, of late, speaking just of those EV sales as we have for Renault as well, starting, of course, with the announcement that at least 10% of employees at Tesla worldwide would be losing their jobs, and ending with another round of price cuts. That news, of course, coming through yesterday. Also, with Evercore warning, markdowns in China do risk wiping out the firm's operating profits in the country. In the meantime, the CEO, Elon Musk, he's cancelled a highly awaited trip to India, the next frontier, as it were, and said goodbye to two of his senior executives, while the firm recalled every Cybertruck it has shipped so far. All this coming after Tesla reported its first fall in deliveries then in nearly 4 years. That happened earlier this month. Significant for this company. And as the company's board then asks shareholders to vote on that $56 billion pay package for CEO Elon Musk, which a Delaware court voided back in January.
Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market-moving news, you can head to cnbc.com or join us again on the show with me, Steve Sedgwick, and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.